Seinfeld family, whom the older members of the community will remember. Her late father, Reb Moshe Oliver Shalom, had a very famous bookshop in the East End, I think in Old Montague Street. And she is, the name Seilingold, as I say, is well known in London circles from the previous generation. In fact, after he got married, he lived in Stamford Hill. I think in Kilders Road. Kazanov Road. And certainly worked in Kazanov Road, where there was the headquarters of the B'nai Akiva. And so he spent his early first few years of marriage, I'm not exactly how long, but certainly he spent them here in Stamford Hill. So that's why I say, Reb Yehuda, welcome home. I know your real home is in Yerushalayim, as indeed it is our home. Our real home is Yerushalayim. But we're, as somebody once said, we're just taking a later train. Just, I want to introduce you to him, and I want to introduce him to you. First of all, let me introduce Lubavitch of London to Reb Yehuda. This building is one of the first Chabad houses to be established in the world. It was founded by the late father-in-law of Rabbi Sudak, Rabbi Ben Tzion Shem Tov, whom I'm sure you knew. And he was the founder, basically, of British Chabad. And it grew from there. So this is like the focus, the center, the merkaz, from which many, many other Chabad houses worldwide have been established. It's a real powerhouse. That from here, Kimitzion Teitei Soira, that from here also Teitei Soira. So that is an introduction of the community over here to you. But just to introduce Rabbi Yehuda to you and to give a little bit of his background, which will give some context to the words he's going to say. His connection with Chabad Lubavitch goes back a number of decades, starting with the fact that he had two brothers-in-law who were Chabadniks. My father, Oliver Shalom, and my late uncle, Laser Klein, Oliver Shalom of Manchester. And so he was familiar with Chabad. And then, in other ways, he crossed paths with Chabad, and to a certain extent, threw in his lot with Chabad. Because early on in his career, when he became the consul in New York, he was invited by the Rebbe to come for Hakafas Shnias for him. That means the Hakafas of Simchas Torah. In Eretz Yisrael, of course, there's no Hakafas of Simchas Torah. There's only one day, but they have Hakafas Shnias. So the equivalent in England, in New York, was to go for Simchas Torah. And the Rebbe invited him as the consul of the Israeli consul to join in the Hakafas in 1967, when he first took up a post abroad. And so he stood next to the Rebbe on that date, Simchas Torah, and that was his first of many, many encounters with the Rebbe and his shluchim. I want to, just of the many encounters, I'm just going to note one of them, which will also tell us something about him. Because I'm sure you all know, not all of you maybe, that he was honored and honored us with being the guest speaker at the Kenes HaShluchim that took place just Shabbos, after Shabbos of Varchim Kislev this year. And he was the guest speaker then, as a result, shared with us many of his experiences. But there's one I want to mention, which is his connection with Chabad of Australia and how he got that connection. Because, as you all know, the capital of Australia is, we have an Australian here and he immediately gave us the answer, it's Canberra, not Sydney, and it's not Melbourne. But the Yiddishkeit in Canberra is, we won't say how many shtiblach there are there. There aren't too many. So what does a Jew do who's a Shomer Shabbos and he wants a minyan for Shabbos and Yom Tov? He has to go to a nearby town. In Australia, nearby means 300-400 miles. So every Shabbos and Yom Tov, Rabbi Yehuda and his wife went to, where do you go in Australia if you want Yiddishkeit? Melbourne. And where do you go in Melbourne if you want Yiddishkeit? Lubavitch. And who was the shliach in Lubavitch in Melbourne? Rabbi Yitzchak Groner Zichron Livracha. And so Rabbi Yehuda developed a very, very close relationship with Rabbi Yitzchak of blessed memory. And this is only one example. How did he get the connection? Because of his mysterious nefesh, that he wants a minyan for Shabbos and Yom Tov. And this is his story of mysterious nefesh for Yiddishkeit wherever he went. As an ambassador, you know, Daniel, when he was in the court in Nebuchadnezzar, was meister nefesh to eat kosher food. Rabbi Yehuda was meister nefesh not just to eat kosher food, but to make sure all the politicians that came to visit the prime ministers that he was involved with also ate kosher food, and that even the goyim had to eat kosher food because it was kosher catering. There's a lot more to say, but I think I've sufficed to introduce you to him, and now I have great pleasure in calling upon His Excellency Rabbi Yehuda Avner to address us.
What Rabbi Freim did not add is, he's my nephew. Toda rabba. Thank you so much. You just heard from Oxford. I pay tribute Rabbi Eli Rachman and his good lady, the Rabbanit. An extraordinary experience to see how this one couple have brought together a galaxy of individuals, some for whom a Friday night, a Shabbos, a challah, a kiddush is natural, and nowhere else to go. And many of whom, this is the first time that they had experienced the enchantment of what a Leil Shabbat is. And so I salute you, really. I would also like to say that Ephraim is quite right, Stamford Hill. Goes back a long time, but I have a confession to make, and please, if you misunderstand me, then don't share it. When I was the ambassador here, and I was the ambassador during the 1980s, that's the Thatcher years, my predecessor Shlomo Argov had been shot, and he lay paralyzed for many years. He died a couple of years ago. And so when I came, I was surrounded by every conceivable security cordon of Scotland Yard, of outriders and motorbikes, of armored cars. And one day, Rabbi Freim and his dear wife Tova, they made a bris. You made the bris. Is this working? It's gone off. Do we have a technician here? Well, this is embarrassing. I shall endeavor to raise my voice. Plug. 1, 2, 3, testing.
It's a cordon.
It's a what?
It's a cordon.
Okay, so I, what's left of my voice, I shall endeavor to project. So Ephraim, you made the bris. Whose was it? We're talking in 1983, 84. And whenever I went anywhere, then Scotland Yard would always send along an advance team to check it out, with dogs to smell it out. And I don't know if you know this, Ephraim, but they came back to me and they advised me not to come, not to go. And I said, why? And they said, well, there is a certain sect in that community which is hostile to your country, and so we recommend you don't go. They didn't mean Lubavitch. But I remember the occasion, the Simcha, vividly. The reason why I was deeply upset, traumatized when the sound system went off is because I really am very tired. The meshuggah, the way they work with these people. But it's a, the adrenaline is pumping. So as I look out upon you this evening, I remembered of Lord James Arthur Balfour, the Balfour, who in his dotage dreamt that he was in the House of Lords making his speech, and when he woke up he found out that he was. That's the state of mind I'm presently in. I also am delighted, positively, I'm relieved that I'm the only speaker this evening. And I say that because a few months ago I was invited here to London to address a Jewish dinner, and I was the 14th speaker. Now, you all know exactly what I mean at this kind of a Jewish dinner. And there were about 300 people in the room by the time the ninth speaker had spoken. There were about 110 people left in the room. And by the time the 12th speaker spoke, there were about 9 people left in the room. And when I stood up to speak, there were 2 people left in the room, but I made my speech. And when I finished, I stepped down and I asked the first fellow, I said, why on earth did you stay? He said, I'm your Scotland Yard security officer. And then when I asked the second fellow, why have you stayed? He said, I'm the last speaker. Now, that's a pretty apocryphal story, but there's an element of truth in these Jewish events, as we all know. Now, tonight, I want to speak about an epic. And it is an epic called Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Zichrono Livracha, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And I want to speak about a different angle, through a different prism, about this unique individual. I want to speak about his moral vision as a statesman and a diplomat in improving our Jewish world. And if I would be speaking to a mixed kind of audience, I would even say improving humanity at large. And as many of you will know, that in this past year we in Israel celebrated our 60th anniversary of the founding of Israel, and he, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in my mind represents an extraordinary chapter in the telling of this tale. In my mind, his is an epic about the Jewish people's most extraordinary visionary in living memory, an immortal whose leadership sparked the torch of Jewish renewal across all continents, a man whose presence was so inspiringly strong it is sustained to this day in the devoted work of thousands of his Hasidim, who dedicate their lives literally to the building of fortresses of Judaism, community assistance and outreach, often, as you know, in the most remote corners of our world. And I sometimes travel to the most remote corners, and their presence is not only indispensable physically, but is a true Kiddush Hashem spiritually. And though, yes, I am not a card-carrying member of Lubavitch, I had the privilege to have been a sort of liaison, an unofficial liaison, between the Rebbe and various Israeli prime ministers whom I served over many years. And it is assuredly an interesting commentary on our political leadership in Israel that they sought in one degree or another, all of them, to maintain some form of contact with this extraordinary luminary who lived under the chestnut and maple trees of Brooklyn rather than under the poplars and pines of Yerushalayim, to which mysteriously he never journeyed. And I never asked him why. I never asked him why, because myself being a mere diplomatic practitioner, I think I was intellectually humble enough to realize that this man dwelt on an entirely different plane, a profoundly mystical plane, one to which I could never aspire. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was a theologian, not a political Zionist. But if Zionism means v'techazen ha'aneinu b'shuvacha l'tzion v'lachamim, then the Rebbe was a fanatical Zionist. The first Israeli leader I ever escorted to meet the Rebbe was Yitzhak Rabin, l'zichron ha'livracha, when he was our ambassador in Washington D.C. in the late 60s, early 70s, after the Six-Day War. And one spring day in 1972, I spoke to Rabin and tried to persuade him to call on the Rebbe in the name of our then President Zalman Shazar, whom you will know many of you was himself of Lubavitch stock, to convey Israel's greetings to the Rebbe on the occasion of his 70th birthday. So off we went to 770, where they entered the headquarters of the Lubavitch movement. And there we were kept waiting so long that Yitzhak Rabin became very fidgety. Now, Rabin, the straight as a die agnostic, felt distinctly uncomfortable among the multitude of bearded men bustling to and fro around him, all identically clad in black suits and fedoras, and he sitting there with a red silk bar mitzvah yarmulke kind of perched like this on his head. That was the only yarmulke I could find for him as we left Washington, the Yelet Tov Yerushalayim yarmulke. I can tell you he looked like an alien in a foreign land. And when we finally were ushered into the inner sanctum, the Rebbe's face beamed a warm welcome. It was an angelic face, half curtained, so to speak, by his square grey beard and topped by the trademark Lubavitch black fedora hat. However, Rabin was totally unmoved. He displayed no interest when the Rebbe spoke to him of things celestial. But once the Rebbe began questioning him about certain of his strategic decisions during the Six-Day War, and you will recall that Rabin was the chief of staff in that war, and then went on to talk to him about Washington affairs in depth, Rabin was totally amazed at this man's knowledge and insight. And what lured Rabin the most, so he told me afterwards, were the eyes. Ask anyone who ever met the Lubavitch Rebbe, and they will talk about those eyes. They were wide apart, arched over by fine eyebrows, their hue, a deep blue, intense and compelling, and exuding wisdom, awareness, kindness, and good fellowship. Yet, as I would later witness, when the Rebbe's soul grew somber, those eyes could dim into an ominous grey, like a leaden sky. I got to know those eyes rather well over the years, and gradually came to understand that they saw things that the average person like me could never see. They were the eyes of one who could discern poetry in the mundane, mystery in the obvious, and large issues hidden in small things. Said Rabin to me as we left, that man is an extraordinary leader of our people. He knows more about what's going on in the Middle East than most of the members of our Knesset. And a short while later, it was a Purim Eve, I escorted our then President Zalman Shazar to meet the Rebbe. And as I said, President Shazar had been born into the Hasidic Lubavitch enchantment. And on his rare visits to New York, he would abjure diplomatic protocol, choosing to call on the Rebbe as his chassid, rather than solicit the Rebbe to call on him at the Waldorf Astoria as head of state. And this greatly aroused the ire of our then Prime Minister, Golda Meir. And Shazar grumbled to me as we were being driven along to Brooklyn in this burnished limousine escorted by NYPD outriders. What does Golda understand of these things? My Mivina. She wouldn't even know what a Lubavitcher Chassid looks like, even if she saw. Well, actually, that was not quite true. I heard her say so myself. She told me that in 1948 she was appointed Israel's first ambassador to Moscow. Stalinism was then at its height. Jews as Jews had no rights, and practicing Jews were persecuted and often driven to Siberia and certainly driven underground. And said Golda to me, that first Shabbat after I presented my credentials, my embassy staff went to services at the Moscow Great Synagogue. It was practically empty. But the news of our arrival in Moscow spread quickly. How did it spread? Lubavitch Hasidim spread the word through their covert network. Throughout the darkest Stalinist days, these Lubavitchers kept the spark alive. So when, said Golda to me, we went a second time, the street in front of the synagogue was jam-packed. So was inside. Close to 70,000 people were waiting for me, she said. And people surged around me, and they stretched out their hands, and they cried out, "Good Shabbos, Goldala," and "Shalom Aleichem, Goldala," and "Goldala Levens also." And all I could say, Mashani, Rak Yocholti Lomar Chazara, could say to them over and over again, Ich dank euch, was ihr habt seid geblieben, Jeden. And that, she thought, was when I knew what Lubavitch had done in Russia in those days. And I understood then, I'm quoting her, that any sacrifice was worthwhile, Lishmor ala lahava, to keep the flame alive. Now in 1977, Menachem Begin was elected Prime Minister, and he had a long-standing and very close relationship with the Rebbe, which, if you think about it, for Begin from Brisk, the Litvak that he was, with the Rebbe, with his Hasidus, it was a unique relationship. And thus it was on the July day of that year, 77, he visited him at 770 to pay his respects and to receive a brocha before continuing on his journey to Washington, there to meet for the first time President Jimmy Carter. And they closeted themselves alone for a good hour, after which it was decided that I would return to 770 to report back to the Rebbe on how the Washington meeting had fared. They then, the Rebbe and Begin, went out to the front door where, amid a blaze of photo flashes, a hard-hitting reporter shouted out, "You, Mr. Begin, you're Prime Minister. So why do you come to see the Rabbi? Why doesn't the Rabbi come to see you?" "A good question," said Begin. And then, truly in an air of deep reverence, he continued, "As I'm on my way to the White House to meet President Carter for the first time, it seems to me most natural to want to seek the blessings of this great sage of the Jewish people." That is word for word. "How great is he?" asked another reporter. "Rabbi Schneerson is one of the paramount Jewish personalities of our time. His status is unique among our people. So yes, certainly, his blessing and counsel will strengthen me as I embark on a mission of acute importance for the Jewish future." "Would the rabbi care to comment on that?" asked the same reporter. "Certainly," said the Rebbe in his heavily accented English. "I accept the honor of the Prime Minister's visit, not in my own account, but in recognition of the Lubavitch movement's dedicated work in spreading the love of God and his Torah among our fellow Jews, wherever they may be." And with that, we drove off to LaGuardia Airport and on to Washington. And here I have to interject with a small digression. If one works closely with an Israeli Prime Minister, as I had done for so many years, I worked for Eshkol, for Golda, for Rabin, and now Begin, one will be in and out of the White House quite a few times a year. For such is the nature of our relationship with Washington, such is the nature of Israel living in a merciless and unforgiving region of the world, we have much strategic exchange with the United States. Now, the three prime ministers I served before Begin, namely Eshkol, Golda, and Rabin, they were not fussy about kashrut at all. It was only when Begin came into office that kosher savoir-faire in high places became de rigueur. But before that, whenever a White House meal was on the agenda, I would call up Mary Lou. Mary Lou was a White House housekeeper, and she would arrange for me a vegetarian dish. Such was the case on the night in June 1975, when President Gerald Ford was hosting Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in the State Banqueting Hall. And there I sat amid the Georgetown elite, the Jewish bigwigs, the New York literati, the academic celebrities and the Hollywood stars, all of them chomping on succulent roast pheasant, roast potatoes and garnished beans, while my plate stood empty and forlorn. For some reason my dish had not turned up. Perhaps it was because my name had been misspelled. My place card had been engraved Yeduha Avner in place of Yehuda Avner. Now, choose a chair to my right, sat the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Brown, who was discussing with the lady on my left, the famous television celebrity, Barbara Walters. And General Brown in so doing, took note of my still empty place setting, and craning his neck, he marked my place card and he called out, "Yaduha, you're not eating with us tonight." Whereupon a butler stepped forward and placed before me a fiesta of colour, consisting of a base of lettuce as thick as a Bible, topped by a mountain of chopped fruits, capped by a blob of cottage cheese, and all crowned by a scoop of whipped cream, so that the whole thingamajig stood about a foot high, and in contrast to everybody else's roast brown pheasant, it glittered and sparkled like a firework, so much so that President Ford himself half rose to note this extravaganza, whereupon he whispered something into Rabin's ear, and Rabin whispered something back into his ear, and instantly the president stood up, held his glass high, and called out to me, "Happy birthday, young fella!" And to the room he said, "Let's all toast the birthday boy!" And with that, the 100-odd guests rose to their feet and all chanted, "Happy birthday, dear Yaduha!" And I slinked sheepishly into my chair, mortified. And after it was all over, I asked Rabin, "Why on earth had you told the president it was my birthday?" And he shot back, and I shall translate verbatim, "What else should I have told him? The truth? And tomorrow there'll be a headline in the Israeli newspapers that you ate kosher and I didn't, and then the religious parties will bolt the coalition, and I'll have a government crisis on my hands. Ani mishuga, am I crazy?" Maaseh shehoya. Now, tesluchuli. Since I was having these nocturnal summonses, if you will, to the Rebbe, usually at a fairly civilized hour, sometimes half an hour, sometimes an hour, once for over 4 hours, and he once asked me, and the reason why I can quote is because always, at the end of every session, I would scribble out immediately what had been said. And I had been trained, being a note taker, to be able to memorize, almost verbatim, that which was said at meetings. And there was on this occasion when the Rebbe once said to me, "Rebbe Yehuda," he spoke Ashkenazis, I spoke Ivrit. Beautiful Ashkenazis. "When you meet other diplomats, do they comprehend? Aval bemet mivinim. What exactly is a Jew?" "And come to think of it," I said, "there are some who do ask." And I cited an occasion when a vaguely inebriated former ambassador from some other country collared me and asked in these words, "Tell me, Your Excellency, what exactly are you Jews? Are you a nation or a religion or what?" I remember the Rebbe chuckling in response and saying that he had met many a Jew who was not quite sure what actually a Jew was. And then he went on to explain something to me that changed my whole perspective on my own personal diplomatic career. And hear well. I'm translating. He said, beginning with Divrei Bilam, "Am levadad yishkon, uvagoyim lo yitchasha." Translated, this is the people that shall dwell alone and shall not be counted among the nations. And he went on to explain that in modern society, we Jews are unique in personifying what he called a people faith personality. Ishiyut dat ve'uma biyachad. That is to say, a seamless blend of peoplehood and religion, born out of the two seminal events which forged us as a people. Yitziat Mitzrayim, when we entered history as a people, a nation, and Ma'amad Har Sinai, when we entered history as a religion, as a nation faith. And he went on to say that a Jew is a synergy of peoplehood and faith. And one cannot separate one from the other, however you try, though many throughout the centuries have indeed tried and always failed. And even as he spoke, I reminded myself that this matter of our identity as Jews had even flummoxed the Queen of England when I presented my credentials to her as the ambassador to the court of St. James. And in a somewhat mystified voice, she said to me, "I do believe this is the very first time I've ever received credentials from a foreign ambassador born in Manchester. How did you manage that?" And I, anticipating the question, I had rehearsed a rather high-minded response. "Said I, Your Majesty, though born physically in Manchester, I was given birth spiritually in Jerusalem, from whence my ancestors were exiled by Roman legions 2,000 years ago." "Were they really?" said the Queen. "How unfortunate." And she began to talk about the weather. Now, this is true. This was something to behold. Here was I alluding to the mysteries of the grand Jewish histories, conundrums, and there was she talking about the weather. What could she possibly know of the dreams of a 17-year-old Jewish boy in Manchester who was driven by an irresistible urge to fight the British to expel them from Eretz Israel? What tools did she possess to comprehend the strange and singular paths of our history, which defy all known historical models, and which, in my humble instance, had carried me back to the country of my birth, bearing the credentials of the country of my birthright? No wonder she was mystified. For, this is now me talking, not the Rebbe. I mentioned before what the Rebbe had explained to me of this indivisibility of what is a Jew. Ummah v'dat b'yachad. It changed my whole perspective on my whole work in the area of diplomacy. And I'll explain why. Because given that as a point of reference, I began to understand Ad kama am levadad yishkon uvegoyim lo yitchashem. For sovereign Israel, we are peculiar in the whole of the family of nations. We are peculiar in that we are the only country in the world that is Jewish. We are peculiar in that we are the only country in the world whose language is Hebrew. We are peculiar in that we are the only country in the world that has no ethnic sovereign compatriots of any sort. We are peculiar in that nowhere does Israel have any independent sovereign kith or kin or any indigenous historic relationship with any other state or group of states or cultures or religions or languages, as do say the Muslim nations or the Christian nations or the Anglo-Saxon nations or the Nordic nations or the Slav peoples or the Francophonic nations or the Spanish-speaking or the Arabic-speaking or the Chinese-speaking peoples. Everybody in the world has sovereign and cultural mishpacha except us. The one blood tie The one kindred bond that we have with anybody at all in the world is with you. Acheinu b'nei Yisrael. And you are everywhere small minorities, and nowhere do you enjoy any form of national or cultural autonomy. So what does this mean? It means that God forbid were the Arabs to win their cause and the Jewish state were to go under, no people in the world would grieve and weep and mourn our loss other than our own Jewish kinfolk. Indeed, no other country in the world is so dependent on its diaspora for its continued existence. And hence, were, for example, the whole of the Irish and the Scottish diasporas to disappear tomorrow, no one doubts that Ireland and Scotland would still be here tomorrow, but not Israel. And this bond between us, of the universal unity of our peoplehood, of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh V'Zeh, is not just a mystical one, it's not just a basic article of our faith, it is a matter of our survival. And the diplomatic consequences of this solitude in the international community are far-reaching. For having no natural sovereign kith and kin, no blood brothers in the family of nations to stand by us in national, cultural or religious solidarity, we are discriminated against, and sometimes effortlessly, and I just witnessed it now at this Shabbat I spent in Oxford. Thus, nobody recognizes the legitimacy of Yerushalayim as our capital. No. We have no membership in any international regional alliance like NATO. We have no full membership in any trade area like the European Union. We enjoy no international recognition of our official medical emblem, the Magen David Adom. We have no accredited membership in any United Nations regional grouping. And consequently, we are the only UN member that has no prospect of ever becoming a member of the Security Council. So yes, we are the odd state out in the family of nations. Am levadad yishkon uvegoyim lo yitchashav. As I said before, after the Washington meetings with the President and the White House, it was my task to return to 770 and call upon the Rebbe as arranged. And we sat alone in his wood-paneled chamber, whose furnishings were so time-worn they were monastic. And as he dissected my Washington report, the Rebbe's air of authority seemed to deepen. It came from something beyond knowledge. It was in the state of his being, something he possessed in his soul, which I cannot possibly begin to explain. My presentation and his interrogation took over 4 hours. It was now well after midnight, and I was utterly exhausted. But not the Rebbe. He was full of vim and vigor. He must have noticed my fatigue, for he suddenly leaned forward, fixed me with those eyes, and he said, with a surprisingly sweet smile, "How come, Rabbi Yehuda, you visit us so often, yet you're not a Lubavitch? Why?" It was true. This was probably my 6th or 7th encounter, and I remember taking a very deep breath and daring to say, maybe because I was so tired, I dare say it, I said to the Rebbe, "Maybe it's because I've met people who ascribe to the Rebbe powers which the Rebbe does not ascribe to himself." I recall his brows knitted and his eyes grayed into something between solemnity and sadness. And he said, Yesh kinire anoshim hazakukim lekobayim. There are evidently people who need crutches. And it was clear to me by the way he said it, that he meant that out there in the world, there are so many who are looking for a meaning to their lives, who are in need of spiritual support, who seek sagacious advice and possibly a lending helping hand. And he, the Rebbe, and through his shluchim, he was there for them all. And then with an encouraging smile, he went on and said, let me tell you what I try to do. I'm not doing duty to the Rebbe, because his language, be'ivris, was so poetic and so beautiful. But this is the best rendering I can do of it in English. He said, let me tell you what I try to do. Imagine, he said, you're looking at a candle. But what you are really seeing is a mere lump of wax with a piece of string down its middle. So when do the thread and the wax become a candle? Or in other words, when do they fulfill the purpose for which they were created? When you put a flame to the thread, then the wax and the thread become a candle. And that is what I try to do, he said, to encourage every individual to fulfill the purpose for which he or she was created. And then his voice morphed into the rhythmic Talmudic chant as he went on to say, Bivris, the wax is the body and the wick is the soul. Bring the flame of Torah to the soul, then the body will fulfill the purpose for which it was created. And that is what I tried to do, to ignite the soul with the fire of Torah. And when I rose to bid farewell, totally whacked, the Rebbe escorted me to his door, and you will recall, nobody from outside could open that latch. They would buzz, but only he could unlatch the door with a buzz of his own. And this was after 2 o'clock in the morning. And there at the door, I asked, Haim HaRebbe Hidlik Et HaNer Sheli? Has the Rebbe lit my candle? No, Umar. Nusati locho es hagafru, rak ato yuchol lahadlik es haner shelcha. I have given you the match, only you can light your own candle. Murai v'rabotai. There are times when I think back with deep nostalgia to those days when the Prime Minister of Israel would ask me to call on the Rebbe to mull over this or that issue of the day. And now, following our elections back home just a couple of weeks ago, I venture to say our new government, whatever it will be, could do with an injection of the Rebbe's wise counsel in the complex circumstances of our region. I still have the notes of a conversation I had with the Rebbe in 1979 after the Iranian Ayatollah revolution, when he analyzed for me the threatening consequences of radical Islam, which by its very inner logic would inevitably seek to spread its venomous doctrine, now commonly known as jihadism. This was before anybody had ever written a word on the subject. On the contrary, the United States was then seeking to placate the Ayatollahs in Iran, was supporting the Islamists in Afghanistan, only to end up in 1981 with the American hostage crisis in Tehran. And so, what is happening today, I can well imagine the Rebbe's usually benign features going to him, as he would surely deduce that Islamic fundamentalism with a nuclear bomb is humanity's calamity, and it will not happen. For who can deny that we've entered a totally new and threatening period of history? The balance of power among civilizations is indeed shifting. Ancient civilizations are expanding demographically and economically, most notably China and India. And the West's universalistic pretensions to spread the growth of democracy have brought it increasingly into conflict with other civilizations, most notably the Islamic peoples, which, given their strategic locations, their large populations, and by a quirk of geology, their ample oil resources, have made themselves very influential in world affairs. Now, when the Rebbe talked about civilizations, he shunned all politically correct clichés like cultural relativism and moral equivalency. People differ, nations differ, civilizations differ. Things happen in one country that could never happen in another country, not least in Eretz Israel. And I think the Rebbe would remind us that in every generation, every tyrant who would have us vanish, whether the Amaleks or the Haymans or the Hitlers or the Ahmadi Jihads of Iran, have themselves all vanished. The notion, the term of Am Yisrael Chai is no mere cliche. Let me end. I was reading this week's Parsha, Truma, the Mishkan, the Aron, the Luchot HaBrit. I reminded myself of an episode that happened no more no less than the Cairo Museum. We had signed a peace treaty with Egypt. Anwar Sadat visited Jerusalem. He invited Prime Minister Menachem Begin back to Cairo, and on his official program was a visit to the famous Cairo Museum, the largest repository in the world of Egyptian ancient civilization. And as you walk from gallery to gallery to gallery, there you see Markavot Paro, and you see Egel HaZahav, and you see it alive of what we know to have been the Mitzrayim B'yamim Ha'im Shelo Yira'eh Od. And as we were walking through the galleries, one of our own Israeli security agents whispered in my ear, "Zoset chalagish katan, nachon? It makes you feel small." And this was in Begin's earshot. And he turned on this young fellow. "I shall translate," he said. "Small? What small? Here we have what was a civilization gathering dust in a museum. And we, with two pieces of stone, we changed the whole world. Without those two pieces of stone, the civilization of humanity would be stagnant." Those are his words. "Muban," said he. And he took this boy, gave him a little pinch on his cheek, Shel Chiba, and he said to him, "Here we are, they are in the museum, Am Yisrael Chai." And I thought of that today. I was thinking of the Binyan HaMishkan, and through the Mishkan, and through those two pieces of stone, Am Yisrael Chai. A Gitavach Shavuot. Thank you. Rebbe Freim. Shall I lech it? Only having quest. Thank you.
Before everybody goes, I want to move a vote of thanks to Rabbi Yehuda for another example of Mesiras Nefesh. He's really whacked out, and he's going back to Eretz Yisrael tomorrow. We wish him Derech Tzlecha. But I just want to modify one thing that he said. He told us that the Rebbe asked him why he's not become a Lubavitcher. Some of you may know that Bnei Akiva, from that he used to work for, the older section of Bnei Akiva is called Bachad. Beis, Ches, Dalet. And it's a small jump from Bachad to Chabad. And I think he's made it. A good avach to everybody. Thank you.